The Devil in the White City is a book about two men whose names and works helped define America on the cusp of a new century. Each was accomplished, handsome, and inventive, but one man was conceivably a genius, the other a murderer. Daniel Burnham was the genius, Chicago's master builder, the man who built with staggering speed a great new skyscraper city out of the ruins of a fire. He created the White City, as Chicago's World's Fairgrounds of 1893 became known, a marvel of engineering and enterprise that forever changed thinking about cities. But Henry H. Holmes was a young pharmacist from the same Chicago who built a twisted dream house of a torture chamber. There he killed scores, possibly hundreds of people, mostly single young women, who'd come from across the world to enjoy or work at the World's Fair in Chicago. In the time of Jack the Ripper, Henry H. Holmes was probably America's first urban serial killer. Eric Larson, who wrote the previous bestseller, Isaac Storm, is the author of The Devil in the White City. He lives in Seattle but joins us from Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure.
Something in common or nothing in common, these two men?
You know, I think actually they had a lot in common, and that's part of what drew me to the story. First of all, on a very physical level, I must note that they both had blue eyes that people constantly remarked about. What I think more than that they shared was the late Gilded Age sense of being able to do anything you set your mind to. And in the case of Burnham, this absolutely heroic effort to build this fair against a Dickensian array of obstacles. In the case of Holmes, Dr. H.H. Holmes, the serial killer, to really become one of the most prolific killers in history.
Each of them, in a way, took advantage of the latest developments of their time.
Very much so. In the case of Dr. Holmes, he used the changes in society and in technology to his advantage. For example, this was an era when young women were really on their own. They were able to travel unescorted from their hometowns to the big city, to live on their own, live in boarding houses, and to hold jobs as stenographers, as typists, and so forth. So he used that. He used trains. He used telegraph. And in this big, mashy stew of Chicago in that era, he was able to go completely undiscovered. It was the ideal setup for a serial killer of this kind.
Paint a picture for us, if you can, please, Mr. Larson, of Daniel Burnham in these times, a name that I think many Americans of our age recognize without quite placing his importance.
Daniel Burnham, in the 1890s, which is the time when this book is mostly set, he was among the top architects in America, and arguably after the fair became the top architect. A couple of his buildings that people might be familiar with, the Flatiron Building in New York, Union Station in Washington.
He's the man who said after the Chicago fire, make no small plans, they have not the fire to stir men's blood. I guess he went on to say, make no small plans, dream no small dreams from this day forward. The motto of Chicago is I will, which is on the city seal.
Yes, indeed. And in that, he certainly followed through. I mean, he is the man also who's responsible for why Chicago has this lovely expanse of lakefront, unobstructed by, you know, tall buildings and cellular phone towers and so forth. It's just a marvel that is a lasting legacy to this city.
In a day in which people jet around the world and can in person see some of the locations that have always intrigued them, is it difficult to appreciate the significance of a World's Fair in a sense that movement coming in reverse and what it represented?
Yes. Getting the fair for Chicago was more than just a huge civic honor. It was a way of showing New York what it could do. And then it became also a way of showing the world what it could do, specifically France. You see, our relationship with France has always apparently been somewhat troubled. And what I'm referring to there is in 1888, there was the spectacular Paris Exposition of 1888, which had eclipsed all previous World's Fairs. And most symbolic of that fair was the Eiffel Tower, which immediately seized for France the honor of being, you know, the foremost engineering and technical power in the world. And so not only was Daniel Burnham trying to raise Chicago's stature in the eyes of the Astors and so forth in New York, but was also trying to out-Eiffel.
I want to get you, if I can, to read a section of the book describing the fair in its full flower in the spring and summer of 1893 and coming to fruition in accord with Daniel Burnham's vision.
Everything about the fair was exotic and, above all, immense. The fair occupied over 1 square mile and filled more than 200 buildings. A single exhibit hall had enough interior volume to have housed the U.S. Capitol, the Great Pyramid, Winchester Cathedral, Madison Square Garden, and St. Paul's Cathedral all at the same time. One structure, rejected at first as a monstrosity, became the fair's emblem, a machine so huge and terrifying that it instantly eclipsed the Tower of Alexander Eiffel that had so wounded America's pride.
And the monstrosity that outdid the Eiffel Tower was the Ferris wheel. I don't mind cutting to the end on that.
This Ferris wheel had 36 cars. Each car carried 60 people. That's 60. And at its highest arc, took people as high as the crown of the Statue of Liberty.
A couple of anecdotes I'd like to get you to tell from the fair.
Sure.
The United States was introduced to the belly dance at the fair.
Yes.
And I'm intrigued by the story of how, what we still think of to this day, when you see somebody, a belly dancer and somebody, a snake charmer, you still hear a tune in almost every sitcom, and that was invented, if I get you to tell the story, and maybe I'll do the tune.
Yeah, the belly dance was, in fact, introduced to America at this World's Fair. However, the entrepreneur who introduced it, Saul Bloom, one day was doing a presentation to the press of the belly dance, and he shows up, and there's no music. There's only a pianist. And the pianist has no idea what to play for a belly dance. So Saul Bloom, he hums a tune, writes it out. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
There's a place in France where they wear no underpants.
Exactly.
Some of us grew up singing it. But it's not Egyptian at all. It's Saul Bloom.
It's Saul Bloom.
How was it that Dr. Holmes came to open his place on the south side of Chicago, a neighborhood called Englewood, not far from the fair?
I would say it was a psychopath's luck, if you will. And as soon as he heard that the fair was going to be sited nearby in Jackson Park, literally due east of his mansion, he began converting it into a hotel for World's Fair visitors, primarily young women.
Now, he had his own special design techniques, didn't he?
Yeah, indeed. What this particular building had, it had acid vats, it had lime pits, it had a dissection table, and also probably the foremost apparatus was a crematorium.
How could workmen build a place like that?
That is part of Holmes's genius. He cooked up a means of hiring teams of workers. They would work for a while, and then Holmes, in mock outrage, would fire them for some flaw that probably didn't even exist. And so he managed to succeed in two things. One, saving a lot of money, and number two, in making sure that no one person knew every detail about this castle that he was building.
I got to get you to describe the what must have seemed to the outside world like an extraordinary train of coincidences, that every young woman who entered his life seemed to disappear.
Well, indeed. Remember, this was a time, the late Victorian era, when, presumably sexuality was something that was fairly suppressed and premarital sex was relatively hard to come by, or so one might think. Holmes proved amazingly adept at not only wooing women, but getting them into sexual relationships, which invariably led to death either in his walk-in gas chamber on the third floor or some other means of disposal.
He would get them to sign over their family assets. He would get them to marry him. He would come up with these, my God, elaborate explanations as to why they couldn't share the same house.
Oh, he was a full-service psychopath on all levels. He killed for the sense of control and mastery over other people, but he killed and manipulated also for financial gain.
Not giving anything away, the law caught up with Mr. Holmes, didn't it?
And caught up with him at a point that I think defies the imagination, and I don't want to give that away, mm-hmm. but suffice it to say that a staunch policeman and an accident brought him to justice.
Did Daniel Burnham ever find out about Mr. Holmes, what was going on?
My feeling is Daniel Burnham was a news junkie. Mm-hmm. He loved reading the newspapers. And I have no doubt that it must have absolutely appalled him to think about this creature walking through this work of art and beauty that he had created. And we know for a fact that Holmes did attend the fair, that he did take at least two of his victims on the Ferris wheel. He did take them throughout the fairgrounds. And how appalling that must have been to Daniel Hudson Burnham to imagine it.
Mr. Larson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Herrick Larson. His new book is The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America.